Welcome to The Rundown. I'm your host, Justin Pugliese. This podcast is dedicated to you, the run community. Each episode, we bring you interviews with top athletes and community leaders. They'll share their stories, tips, and tricks to inspire and motivate you to keep running. Ultimately, we're all just here to have fun. From elite runners to weekend warriors, find out how people get started and why they keep going. So listen up, tell your run buddies, and don't forget to subscribe. You can find us on Apple Music, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Previously on The Rundown with Leisha Mancini.
I never pushed myself, and I didn't try to test my limits, and now it's what I do all the time. And every time I do test my limits, and every time I do start like an ultra or 100K or whatever, I'm always like, it kind of feels like a pilgrimage, and I could accomplish anything. And I think that's something that I didn't have when I first started running. I didn't have faith in myself or the belief that I could accomplish anything big.
On this episode of The Rundown, I spoke with former pro triathlete and World Cup champion, Andrew McMartin. As a teenager, he took a liking to endurance sports, but when he heard about triathlon, that became his focus and made a goal of becoming one of the best. Despite tremendous success as a pro triathlete, he decided to step away from the sport he loved. Now, after a long hiatus, he's back on track with a new goal in mind. This episode of The Rundown is presented by the 2020 WRG Classic. If you know me well enough, you know that I have two passions when it comes to sport, running and hockey. For the last 3 years, I've participated in an awesome outdoor hockey festival called the WRG Classic. It's a fundraiser working to bring hockey to underserved communities in Montreal through hosting a tournament and outdoor winter festival. Guests, participants, and spectators dress in early 20th century fashion and share a fun day of hockey-inspired games, activities, food and drinks, and live entertainment. This year will be the biggest edition ever, adding a full weekend of outdoor fun, including live music, DJs, activities for kids, a mini dog park for canines, and of course, a hockey-inspired retro diner-style food station in partnership with September Cafe. The WRG Classic Festival will take place January 24th to the 26th at Parc Vinette, only steps away from the Lanaudière Metro Station. So make sure to claim your free ticket as soon as you can. Visit wrgclassic.com. That's wrgclassic.com. See you out there. In this week's news, I want to talk about the bushfires happening in Australia right now. It's already killed 20 people and left thousands homeless. It's hard to watch these disasters happening in other places of the world, but as runners, there's something we can do to help. We can join the Relief Run and give our support. The Relief Run is a 21.1K or 5K virtual run that you can complete anytime between Saturday, January 18th to Sunday, January 19th. It's $50 to register, with all proceeds going to the Australian Red Cross Disaster and Relief Fund. Enter alone or as a team. Either way, let's make our run count and help those who need it. Simply go to reliefrun.com.au to register. The winner of the 2019 Golden Shoe Awards Runner of the Year goes to Gabriella Debu Stafford. It's so well deserved. She's such an incredible athlete who had an amazing 2019 season, breaking 8 Canadian records. She now holds the national record for the outdoor 5,000 meter, 1,500 meter, and mile, as well as the indoor 5,000 meter and mile too. Gabriella is clearly one of Canada's best hopes for a medal at the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo this summer. But as I mentioned in the New Year's bonus episode, let's look back and celebrate what we've done so we can reset, refocus, and set new big goals for the year ahead. Make sure to check the show notes for links and more information. That's all for now. Gotta run. When I've interviewed professional athletes, usually I get them when they're a current professional athlete. My next guest was a professional triathlete, but just a few years ago. He's still an endurance athlete and still a very strong one, but it'd be interesting to go through his journey as a professional and kind of where he's gotten to today, especially in the marathon. So I'd like to introduce to you Andrew McMartin.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming in.
Yeah.
I don't know if I kind of got that right, but looking back at all your past achievements, it's been really impressive to see, and it's going to be interesting to talk to you
taking a step back, and I'm sure you've had a lot of time to reflect since then.
Definitely. And it's probably a good story for a lot of people that are younger, because I got out and then got back into sports. And probably that time was long enough that those who are sort of in their 20s or early 30s may not even know about when I was a professional triathlete. So hopefully it'll be a good story for people.
Yeah, I hope so too. We'll get into it. And just to see kind of, you know, you're a Montreal guy. You're born and raised here. And just to see what your upbringing was like and how you got into sport in the first place.
Yeah, for sure. So you're right. So I grew up in Montreal. I was born here. My family is from Montreal. And like every kid that grows up in Montreal and Quebec, I played hockey. I wasn't amazing, but even when I was 7, 8, 9 years old playing hockey, I always noticed that I was good with endurance. And I wasn't great with a shot, but my coaches would always let me stay on a little bit longer because I would never get tired. So I would play left defense, and that was a lot of fun. And we had outdoor rinks at the time, so big part of my upbringing was hockey. But nothing formal in terms of endurance, other than that sort of the required stuff that we had to do in school, the Canada fitness test and whatnot. It really wasn't until I was 14 years old. I went to boarding school. There was a boarding school called Sedberg near a town called Montebello, in between, I guess, Hawkesbury and Ottawa, all boys school. And I went there, and, you know, long story short, it was a good experience for me. It was good for my grades, good for a lot of things. But that was the first time that I really was exposed to endurance sports, and it was the Terry Fox Run. And the first week that we were there, on the Saturday, we had the Terry Fox Run. So parents drove back up, and it was a point-to-point. We were all put in a Bluebird yellow school bus and driven 10 kilometers from school, and it was a 10-kilometer run back to school. And I ended up getting second place overall. It was a boarding school from grade 3 to grade 12. So I was in grade 8, I guess, and I got second place. And it was kind of like, wow, like, how did that happen? And I'd never really been good at much before that, especially anything sporting-wise. So it was a bit of an eye-opener for me. And that fall, I continued with cross-country running for the first time. So I got on the cross-country running team. And then in the winter, it progressed to, I was going to do downhill skiing, but they convinced me to get into cross country. And they said, well, actually, you should like it because you play hockey. And there's this part of cross country skiing called skate skiing, which is similar to hockey in terms of how you push off. So you'll probably like it. And it's good for cross country running training. So boarding school was really where I got exposed to that, and then started to notice that I actually had a lot of endurance. And stayed there for a few years and really fell in love with endurance sports, or we used to call it high performance sports, which okay. would have been cross country skiing, cross country running, triathlon was becoming one of those. And it was fantastic. So
and that was all part of the school program?
The school program was really, so it was a British based type of school where you had even school on Saturdays. A half day on Saturday, then you had to build a hut. So on the weekends, you'd sleep in your huts, and it was very outdoors. And the academics were strong, but we had 2 hours of sports every day. And in the fall, you had choices. So you could do soccer, you could do open water sports, so canoeing, kayaking, or you could go on the cross country running team. And the winter was similar. You could do the downhill skiing, hockey, or you could do cross country skiing. We had a rugby team as well. So that's really where I got exposed to it.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting you say that, because I kind of had I didn't go to boarding school or anything like that, but playing hockey, like I started late, but I would always be out there practicing my skating, and like I could skate forever, and like, oh, like I played midfield in soccer. So like, it's interesting like how there's some parallels there. Like I'm not a professional athlete by any means, but just to say like, even within those sports, you kind of take a liking to more of an endurance type role,
yeah.
rather than like maybe you're not the fastest or whatever. But
yeah,
it's interesting looking back. You know?
Yeah, and it wasn't something about not liking team sports either. I feel that it's we often have a natural desire to want to be good at something. And so when we stumble upon things that we happen to be good at, then it triggers something inside. And for me, it was just like I became very passionate about sport. And I'm sure part of it was just because I saw that I was good, but I wasn't exceptional from the start. I wasn't winning cross country races from the start. I had a lot of endurance. And then I think it teased out sort of my grit and my ability to persevere and stay with it and work hard. And I developed a work ethic. And then I saw the results come quickly. And when you're 14, 15, you know, you're still growing. And so you're going to see a lot of improvements. And so as I saw those improvements, I became more and more motivated. And, you know, the cross-country skiing actually became sort of the focus. And funny enough, I was a better cross-country skier than I was a runner. And at the beginning, probably even a better cross-country skier than I was a triathlete. But then we'll get into triathlons. Mm-hmm. That was something else.
Did the coaches help you with that structure? Or did, like, because you were super young at that age. I mean, I didn't have much structure at 14, you know, like, other than, you know, go to school and play your sport and get your homework done and stuff like that. So was it being part of the boarding school that allowed you to kind of get that discipline down?
The boarding school definitely gave the discipline just because of, you know, the way that things are structured. There's, you know, you get up at a certain hour, there's dorm inspection. So there's structure that you really can't change there. And you either sort of comply with it or you're going to have a problem. But in terms of sport itself, no, I would say there was a fundamental program of cross country running and a fundamental program for cross country skiing. But really what I did and what I loved about it, and we didn't have internet and there wasn't social media, so everything was about research. And from a very young age, I remember, and I still, because I journalized everything, I did my own research. So you had like Arthur Lydiard, and you had a lot of people throughout the years who had written about endurance sports. And I remember going and finding papers and learning about this thing called anaerobic threshold at a very young age. You know, I had a friend of mine that we were close and we trained together. And so we would make up our own theories about racing and about, you know, rate of perceived exertion. So it was interesting because there was a creative side of it that I remember sort of not really being aware of any limitations, because I wasn't able to sort of go out and see what the rest of the world was doing. You're sort of in your own little bubble and you're getting good. So you're kind of creating this vision in your mind of like what you can become, and you're researching and you're reading. And I think that was a fun part of it for me. Definitely.
Mm, that's interesting. Yeah. And it's like those sports don't really have the notoriety or the, excuse me, the attention that maybe like hockey would or football would, or where there's such a history and it's on TV all the time and all this stuff too. So it's cool. Like you said, you were in your little bubble.
Yeah.
And the limitations were whatever you had to deal with in your school or other schools that you would race against, I guess, or,
yeah,
to push yourself. So like the idea of like no limits and stuff, it probably came to you at like a really young age, which sounds like,
yeah, there were no preconceived notions of reality really. And the big influencers were, you know, Greg LeMond definitely was the American cyclist who at that time had not won his third Tour de France yet, but he had won, I think, two of them, and then he had a hunting accident. But he put out a book called The Complete Book of Cycling, which was really good. It was lots of pictures of how to like clean your bike, but he had a training program in the back, and he broke it down by sort of beginner, intermediate, and pro level for cycling. Pro level was like 600 kilometers a week kind of volume. So that was my first way of seeing, okay, well, this is how the best in the world at an endurance sport train. Like 600 kilometers equates to how many hours? Is that about 20, 25 hours a week? And then, you know, getting into triathlons, starting to use that as a framework, so to speak, of, okay, well, what would I do in triathlons? But, you know, there was Greg LeMond, there was others, there were niche things, like cycling was definitely sort of one of these things that was not popular, but those who were into it were really into it. And there were like legendary stories of cyclists in Europe, you know, riding in like 0 degree weather with just, you know, a shirt on and shorts and being really tough. And so there was this whole like side of like endurance sports that really appealed to me about being tough and having grit and perseverance.
Yeah, and especially in the endurance sports, it's like such a long distance and like not a lot of people could do it. Like I still get this like idea it's pretty like badass sport, you know, like to be able to grind it out for like a full, like for most people it's a work day, you know, and for us, we're just going out to do it for pleasure, you know?
Yeah.
But it's a blessing too at the same time. What gave you the introduction to biking? Cause like you mentioned like cross country, running, some water sports, so you were in the water quite often.
Right.
But where did the biking...
The biking came in. So as I started to learn a little bit more about cross training and what do cross country skiers do, cycling was the sport that came up. So I was learning that, you know, cycling was a good sport to use as cross training in the summer. Just, you know, the quads, the legs, the cardio. So I convinced my dad to get me a bike and I started to do some cycling in the winter. And that would have been probably 1987. Mm-hmm. And then I started to really enjoy that. I didn't even have clipless pedals yet. So I was riding around with a big, giant, clunky helmet and got my first bike at ABC Cycles. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing. And I just enjoyed, now I could go out and I could travel like 50 kilometers. Like I could ride from my house to the West Island, come back. Those days you could actually take the service road on the 40 and come back. There were no cars. It was amazing. But you were now free. So, and you've heard that before with other people who talk about cycling, just the sense of freedom. So I really, really enjoyed it. And then I saw also that I was getting very fit. And so in the summer, I would do the cycling and then I would do a little bit of running as well. And so you had the makings of, okay, well, the only other sport that's missing is swimming. And, you know, growing up in Quebec, there's lots of lakes and whatnot. So I had learned how to swim and I wasn't a competitive swimmer. I think my parents had tried to throw me into a swim club when I was maybe 10 and, you know, I skipped out and ducked into the showers and that didn't last too long, but I could swim. I was always okay, comfortable, enjoyed the water. So the cycling was really just a natural, I guess, stepping stone there. And the cross-country skiing, triathlons really didn't start until 1988. And at that point, it was really just a coincidence that I read in the paper one day that they were going to have a triathlon in Montreal. And there was this triathlete, actually he's a pretty well-known guy in Montreal, Paulo Saldana. Mm-hmm. I think he owns Power Watts and McGill grad, and so he was on the front cover and on a skateboard, and he had done Ironman, I think, and he might have even at that point had the Canadian record for the Ironman, and they were featuring him as the favorite for the Montreal triathlon. And so I said to my dad, well, I'm gonna turn 16 by the time that race happens. You have to be 16 years old to do a triathlon. I'd love to do it. So he took me up to a lake near Saint-Sever and said, well, you got to be able to show me you can swim. So I swam in the lake. That was good. Unfortunately, about a week before the race, out in the East End on Sherbrooke, I hit a pothole and crashed and ended up breaking my collarbone. Again, you have no cell phones, no nothing. I'm still 15 years old. I just turned 16. So about 5 hours later, my mom finds me at one of the hospitals, broken collarbone, almost compound fracture.
Oh, wow.
And so I didn't get to do the race that year. That would have been, I think, 87. My first year was 88, so that would have been 87. And I went back to school and eventually recovered from the break, but had it in my mind the next year, I'm definitely going to be doing a triathlon.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very cool. So were you racing, like... I mean, obviously your injury probably stopped you, but were you still running and doing these cross country racing from like between like intermediate, like between 14 and 16, let's say?
Yeah, definitely. So I started running and, I basically ran cross country. I went to provincials, was a good cross country runner, probably for a frame of reference with people that are old enough to remember. I was running with guys like Yannick Lambert and I wasn't quite as fast as Yannick, but he became, I think, about a 28-minute 10K runner. But like, I was in that kind of, you know, I would say pedigree of cross-country running. Cross-country skiing, the same thing. I was better at cross-country skiing, though. I think I won Eastern Canadian Championships one year. like skate skiing when I was 15, like sub 30 minutes for 10K skate skiing. So I was pretty fast. Did the Canadian Ski Marathon, the whole 100 miles to Cour du Bois when I was 15 years old. It was one of the coldest years ever. And I think very few people finished. But I continued doing the cross-country running right up until sort of like late high school. They had the GMAA cross-country meet here in Montreal and ran that one year. And then just sort of phased out, I think, as triathlons became more and more of what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I got closer to the end of high school, let the cross-country skiing go because I wanted to really focus on triathlon training. So didn't really have the time anymore to do the skiing. And the running just naturally sort of faded away with the racing schedule for triathlons. Mm.
And how dedicated were you as a, like, knowing you wanted to do a triathlon, a triathlete, what was the structure like? Because I know early on when I got into triathlon, it was like, okay, just know you can do whatever distance you're going to train for. Mm-hmm. Not, it wasn't for performance. Now you, like, at that stage probably experienced some better results with running. So was that, did that transfer to triathlon? Did you want to perform in triathlon, or was it just like, I want to try this out and like, I want to just get the distance done.
Yeah.
And like, what did the training look like? It's 16 years old, you know?
Well, the first race that I did was, and it was in 1988, and it was in Milton, Ontario, and it was the Canadian Championships. It's basically almost 700 people on a small beach, start at the same time, jump in to a small lake. And I really just wanted to complete it. And the whole family drove down to Ontario. I remember my grandmother, my nonna, was there, and she had her lawn chair and she was sitting there. And it was just the experience of saying I completed a triathlon. It was an Olympic distance. And I think I finished in about 2 hours and 10 minutes. Was walking a bit on the run because I had cramps, mm-hmm. just because I hadn't been used to sort of being in that arrow position, which, by the way, back in those days, when you rode in the arrow position, sometimes you got stopped by people in their cars and they were like, what are you doing? It was very new. You know, this had been taken from downhill skiing, the whole concept of that arrow position that downhillers would use. So the bars, mine actually were makeshift bars. They were basically two pieces of aluminum and someone had welded them together and you clamped them onto your bike. It was really at the beginning. But just finishing the race and then afterwards sort of everyone hanging out and having a bit of like a picnic almost with, you know, the post race, I found that to be, that resonated with me. And that was the difference between the running races and the cycling, which were more formal and you would sort of do the race and then you would leave. This was like the whole afternoon was like hanging out with people, talking about your race. I can liken it a little bit to the sense of accomplishment of running a marathon. I think just because the distance is so long and you've raced for 2 to 3 hours, there's just a sense of like you're proud of yourself. So everyone wants to sort of like talk about their story afterwards and hang out. And I just walked away. I said, I love this. This is amazing. Mm. And I carried on that summer of 88 and did the Montreal Triathlon, which has been going ever since. Again, like around 2 hours and 7 minutes, I think. In a shorter race in Saint-Lambert, which was a sprint distance. And then I did another one up at Mont-Tremblant, which was around an Olympic distance race. So four triathlons the first year and absolutely fell in love with it. And at that point was like, I'm hooked. This is what I want to do. I think that the idea of having specific goals started after that. So the first year was really, okay, this is how, you know, I ran for maybe 40 minutes for the 10K, maybe a little over an hour for 40 kilometers on the bike. There's probably open water swimming around 21 minutes. And then you start to think, okay, well, like what was the winning time? You know, the winning time at my first race was an hour and 50 minutes. So how fast did he run? Oh, he ran 35 minutes. And then you start to benchmark and you start to compare and then the goals start to happen. That was my first frame of reference, mm-hmm. I think, the first year.
I think that's a good point you bring up. And I try and do the same thing now, or kind of always have. Like the first time I do anything, I just do it to complete it. You don't know what it's like to run a 10K or 5K or half or marathon, but at least then, you know, do your best, get it done. And then at least you have like, it's a PB, first of all, right. First time you do any distance. And then you have something to work on, you know? You have like, okay, I was able to do that comfortably and it hurt like hell, but I can now go to the, I can go and put some work in and try and improve those times. Did you like that? How were you into like the process more or the racing early on? Like the racings, I know it's exciting, and I think you can agree now it's like the process is like everything, but what was it like then, and what were some challenges that you faced early on with triathlon and just like, you know, when you set a goal, then it becomes a little bit more serious than just like this is a, like it's still fun, but you know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And if we go from 1988 and now we move, you know, 1989, 1990, definitely I'm a process person. The racing, I like racing. I like the idea of having accomplished a goal in a race. But for me, I always said, even from a very young age, celebrate before the race, because the process is really what you should be proud of. And for me, mapping that out, even a full year of periodization was a lot of satisfaction from that. So I would definitely look at a process and figure out, what do I want to accomplish the following year? Break it down in terms of maybe improvements in each sport, overall volume, maybe some key races, like, you know, my A race and like my dream. How would I, you know, what would be my dream objective for that race? What would be my second and my third? The basic ways that a lot of people look at how they want to perform, but mapping that out. And I, in fact, mapped out about 10 years at a very young age and sort of reverse engineered back. And, you know, I said, I want to be the best in the world at triathlons. And I think it's going to take me 10 years to get there. And this is how I'm going to do it. And so that started with creating these annual periodizations of like how much I can handle in terms of volume now. How am I going to get to that 600 kilometers a week that Greg LeMond's doing? Like, how many years is going to take me to get there in each sport? And the challenge is, especially probably around, you know, so the progression for me was like 1988, 2 hours and 10 minutes. 1989, same course in Montreal, 1 hour, 54 minutes. And then 1990, then I started to get pretty fast. I went to the Commonwealth Games. They had a demonstration sport for triathlons. They had a senior and a junior division. I got a silver medal in the junior race. Was making very large improvements in those first few years. So now I was starting to look at, well, who can I train with? And I was starting to realize that that maybe where I'm living is starting to become a bit of an issue, because I had no problem motivating myself. I could sit on a wind trainer in my basement and ride for 2 to 3 hours, but I wasn't around people that were a lot faster than me. And I was figuring out too that the process has to also include the right level of competition and training so that I know what's the next level. It's easy to sort of train by yourself or train locally and not be, you know, for instance, for running, you might be a 35-minute 10K runner. If you're the fastest and you're not ever running with 33-minute 10K runners, you never get pushed just that little bit. And it's not to say you overtrain, but it just stretches you a bit. And so I started to think, okay, well, where are people training where they're much faster than me, and I can go and I can get exposed to that and sort of get to the levels that I want to get to. So easy to design the process. Logistically, living in Montreal, cold climate, was something in the back of my mind I was thinking about. But of course, I was still going to school, so, you know, I can't just like leave and go down somewhere else, but I was thinking about it, and mm-hmm. that goal of becoming the best and wanting to maybe try this professionally was starting to really kind of percolate in my mind, especially by 1990, after the Commonwealth Games, and I went down to Auckland, New Zealand, and I really didn't want to come back. And my dad was like, you get on a plane and you mm-hmm. get back. Mm-hmm. But I was starting to think, this is fantastic. Like, if I can make a living from this sport, this would be amazing.
Mm. And was there any like financial rewards after like coming and getting a silver medal and starting to place really high in these races?
Well, it's interesting. So there wasn't any financial rewards, certainly in the first few years. What I did is I was looking for sponsors to help a little bit. So I wrote out a letter, a cover letter, almost like a job application. I think I did about 150 of them. And I mailed them to a bunch of companies, and I got some interest back, some interest back. So some of them would say, well, we'll give you $500, you know, to help you for the year. Or there were some distribution companies in Montreal that would have, like, you know, tires and bike equipment, and they'd say, well, we'll give you X amount of equipment to help you out. So there was some support. What I liked about high performance sport back in those days, and I think it was largely due to the influence of, we had Pierre Harvey, we had Gaétan Boucher.
Oh, no, Pierre.
We had some really world-class athletes out of Quebec that were going to the Olympics, and they were well known. And we also had some writers at, like, La Presse and the Gazette who were into high performance sports, and they were supporting these sports. So, like, if Pierre was doing a race, like, we were going to read about Pierre in the sports section. Gaétan, we were going to read about Gaétan in the sports section. And then as triathlon came along, we would read about triathlons. And this helped, I think, justify to grassroots sponsors that, yeah, you know what, it's worth putting a little bit behind. It wasn't golf, it wasn't tennis, but getting enough just to sort of help you along. And race directors, interestingly enough, in Montreal were able to get some good prize money together. So in 1990, 1991, there was a duathlon series. So it wasn't triathlon, it was run, bike, run. But there were six races, and I think it was about $500 for first place. Mm. And then there was like $2,500 for winning the overall series. So when I was 18 years old, and I think I had won five out of the six races, you know, that's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you're starting to say, okay, I'm not a golf player. I'm not going to become a millionaire from this, but I am making enough maybe to pay for my rent. And that's all I need. Like, mm-hmm. I don't need a lot of money. I can go down to somewhere warm. Maybe if I can, you know, get that good. And how much do I need for groceries? And you're not thinking in big dollars. You're just thinking, how much money do I need to do this sport full time that I love?
Mm-hmm.
And the sport was very entrepreneurial, so it was lending itself well to people that were creative enough to think of different ways to go and convince companies to give you a free product or, you know, a token sum, like small dollars, just to maybe help you get to a race, pay for your gas.
Yeah, that's great. And I think it's interesting, like, and we have to remember that the time that you're talking about when you were competing, it really was like, it's not as big as triathlon is today with the Ironman and all the marketing behind it and all this stuff. Like, it really was grassroots, and it really was like these, like, international but small events that didn't get as much attention as they do now. You know, like,
absolutely.
There's a super series now, and they, you know, you go to the Old Port and they still do the ITU races there, and you get athletes from all over the world, and it was a lot different than it is today. And were you getting, like, I mean, there was international competition surely in those races back then as well, even in its early stages. Was that a cool part for you to kind of see, like, how you stacked up against other people in other parts of the country or other parts of the world as well?
Yeah, absolutely. The sport, so the first time that I really saw that was the World Championships in Avignon, France in 1989. That was the first ITU Congress and really the beginning of what was a movement to, you know, not only get the sport of triathlon in the Olympics, but triathlon also was a forerunner in terms of equal rights, so like equal prize money for men and women. And there was even a boycott at that race, or a potential boycott at the beginning, to say that if the men and women did not have equal prize money, then the men were not going to race. So it was very interesting. And I was staying at a hotel, and I remember Mark Allen and Mike Pigg, these are big names from the past, walked into the hotel lobby. And I remember looking over at Mark Allen, and my dad was there, and I was just like, there's no way in the world I'm ever going to be that fit. And I was just looking at how muscular he was and how fit he was. I was 17. He was probably 30 years old. And, you know, that was 1989. And how would I know that, you know, 3 years later, I'd be sort of competing at that level? But really kind of just seeing that for the first time, going to a training pool. There was another Australian that I became friendly with, Miles Stewart, who actually won the Pro Men's event in 91. He was a phenomena. Some said that I was also a phenomena, but he was 17 and already like top five in the world. Watching him train before that race and just kind of noticing, okay, there's this level here. Like my 58 minutes for 40K on the bike is not going to cut it. There's, you know, my 34 minutes or 35 minutes off the bike for running is just not going to cut it. Swimming, watching, you know, Miles do like dive 27 second 50s in a long course pool, saying, okay, they've got to take this up to another level. What we were seeing with the sport, and I think you said it well, is that it wasn't as big as it is now, but it was locally quite large in parts of the world, Australia being one of them, England, and frankly, Canada being another place where we were sort of finding that there were people from the US, Canada, Australia, and parts of Europe who just wanted to quit their jobs and do this sport, and they would travel and get on teams and really train very, very hard. I mean, train as if they were, you know, like 30, 40 hours a week. And so people were getting good at triathlons. It wasn't maybe at the same level it is today, but there was depth that was starting to happen. And this was really kind of interesting to see. So Avignon was the first time I saw that. And then it just went from there. Each time I went to a race and I was competing at a more and more competitive race, I was starting to see the depth of that and just, okay, there's a lot of people that are taking this sport really seriously. I was really starting to believe now that I could do this for a living. I could see that. And that was, you know, sort of 89, 90, and then definitely 91 was kind of like that turning point just before I turned pro.
Mm. And what was there an aha moment, or was it like you said, you plan out years in ahead. So like you saw yourself becoming a professional, you saw yourself competing at the top level. You wanted to be top in the world, but like, was there a moment when you're like, I don't think you can ever say I've made it, but like, okay, I can hang with these guys.
Well, it was definitely for me, 91. That was a turning point year for a lot of my training in terms of improvements. So what I was looking for, number one, I'd already figured out that the sport, you know, because you could see in the newspapers or in the magazines when people would win races, they'd often put the prize money. Mm. So I was sort of adding up like how much, you know, theoretically could you make if you were in the top 10 in these races. And I was kind of getting to like, oh, you know, you can make like 25, 30 grand a year. And frankly, you know, in the early 90s, if you could do that, that's going to pay for basically all of your rent and all of your groceries and whatnot. You could do it. But what I was looking at was how fast I really needed to be. So I knew, you know, the swimming was a big piece of that. And I actually swam with a club for an entire winter, like double workouts to get my swimming down. Because I knew I needed to swim to win international level races. I needed to be sort of no slower than 17 and a half minutes for 1500 meters. And the cycling was a bit the same thing. I knew that there wasn't any drafting. You had to ride on your own. I knew that you needed to ride about 55 to 54 minutes for 40 kilometers. And then the running, if you wanted to win an international event, you had to run no slower than 32 and a half minutes. There was like a few people that were getting away with 33, but you had like Miles Stewart and Mark Allen and Simon Lessing. You had runners that were already 31 very high off the bike, you know, non-drafting, well, which told me that they were clearly sub 30 minute 10K runners fresh. So 91 was a big year for me, especially the swimming. I got my swim down to 17 in a long course pool. The running, I got down. You know, I never did any track events, and I'm sort of I wish I did, because my times probably would have been pretty impressive and might have even had a couple of notable running times here in Quebec. But there was one race in particular in the fall of 1991 where it was a 12K race, started at McGill on the track, and then it ran all the way up Chameleon Hood, all the way to the cross, and then all the way back down and finished on the track. So it was 12 kilometers. And I got out leaned at the end for first place. So I came second. We ran 36 minutes and about 50 seconds. But we were, and the guy that beat me was I think either Canadian marathon champion or right up there, and I forget his name. But just kind of seeing the running had progressed now. We were coming downhill, but we were 17 minutes to the top, and we were like 31 flat for 10K. So you can do the math and figure out how fast we came down that hill. It was 245 kilometers. So I was like, okay, the running is really coming along. This is good. The cycling was always sort of my strength. So I was putting it together and saying, I think I can be at that level. And there was one race in Montreal at the Olympic rowing basin where, and it's funny because RDS was televising it. It was like 2 hours of like television coverage, but I won that race in an hour and 48 minutes. And those, that kind of a time was world class at, in the 90s, you know, with a, make it a, probably a 19 minute swim open water. The bike was fast, 54 minutes. And then the run, I think I ran about 32, very low. And that to me was one of them. I said, okay, now I'm at that level. Like 1 hour, 48 minutes in a non-draft triathlon was good enough to be, you know, taken seriously at an international level. So I had a conversation with my dad and I said, I'm going to basically let school go and I want to move to California and I want to give this a shot. And he wasn't happy, but eventually we said, okay, you know, if that's what you want to do, just, he made me promise that I would eventually go back if it didn't work out, but eventually, even if it did work out, that I wouldn't just sort of like let the schooling go forever. And the late fall of 91, there were some World Cup races, and back in those days you could get into them, you didn't really have to qualify. So there's one in Ixtapa, Mexico. And there was the World Duathlon Championships that was somewhere in the desert in California, 10K run, 60K bike, 10K run. I went down and did these races and sort of finished my 1991 season. And then I hung out with some friends in near San Diego and just living the life.
Yeah.
You know, just living the life.
Yeah.
And came back for Christmas and I was like, January 1st, I'm going back. And if we come back to that process and that periodization, that's where I drafted out that for that winter of 1992, I drafted out sort of my master plan of what I was going to do. And it started with, you know, 16 weeks of serious base. And don't forget those days, like Arthur Lydiard and that concept of high volume was still very, very popular. You know, if some is good, more is better. So high volume. And that's what I did. I moved down to California and trained as a professional in the winter of 92.
And you did that full time. Like I was going to say, like through all that, until that point, you were still going to school and training and to become like the best athlete or best version of a triathlete that you could be.
Yeah. I'd finished high school and, because of the Commonwealth Games, I'd actually moved out and did grade 12 in Victoria. And then came back to Montreal. And so I had the high school out of the way and then just, instead of going to Cégep and on to university, I really just stopped and moved down there full time. And I stayed in San Diego or near San Diego in a town called Del Mar from January until the ITU, or now it's called the WTS, started with the first race, which was probably around April, and trained there. I had a few friends. We rented a house and we trained like it's... The training sometimes on Instagram and on Facebook, I've posted a few pages from those journals. I'm not sure I would recommend it to a lot of people, but there were some legitimate 40-hour training weeks in there. It was basically 16 weeks, your classic 3 weeks up, 1 week down, and very, very high volume, swimming, you know, 25 to 35,000 yards. Cycling was probably in the 400 to 500 kilometers a week. Running 80 to 100 plus weights day in, day out, and really a lot of it by myself. I'm going to swim practice so there, you know, with other people, but very intense. And what it had done is it had added to the years prior to that where I had started doing the cross-country running and cross-country skiing, but gave me just a tremendous aerobic base because I was still only 19 years old. And so it, you know, when you're young like that, that aerobic conditioning, like there's a point where you can really kind of like crank out that VO2 max and it sort of stops probably in our mid-20s. But I think that long, slow distance, that over like 30, 40 hours of training, just going on a 200-kilometer bike ride, just gave me like this aerobic engine. And I luckily didn't burn out because some did. Some were training that hard that winter, and it was not easy. But for me, I was able to sort of recover from it and then go on to have just an unbelievable season in 92 and really got to like another level.
That's awesome. And so what was the intensity ratio to volume?
Well,
like, you know, whenever we think about like improving and getting faster, like I think this is something maybe I'm learning more about and struggling with. And, you know, it's sounds like you were building your own training programs even at that time. But reading a lot about what, I mean, the book is written on all these theories and all these best practices for training, and we've adapted them over the years and learned a lot. But like you were saying, like a lot of what you're learning is what you're reading.
Yeah.
And even today we kind of do the same thing. You know, we hear a podcast now, or we hear an interview, or we talk to somebody who's had success, and what do they do? And then that's all of a sudden what we believe is the right way to go about stuff.
So, yeah.
So what was I'm starting to think now that after listening to a lot of endurance athletes that the volume is okay. The key workouts are important, but a lot of the volume is done at low intensity.
Yeah.
So
I think, and it was probably perhaps by accident at the time, because you're right that I did do a lot of research back in those days to be honest, if you wanted to get really good research, you had to go to the McGill Medical Library or something like that to find sort of, you know, peer reviewed studies, double blind studies and things that weren't biased to find out how training was done or how testing was done. But the 80-20 rule seems to be probably where I was landing. My max heart rate back in those days tested, I used to get my VO2 tested at McGill University, was 204 beats per minute. For a 10K race, I could hold around 193 beats per minute. And I was probably training most of the time on the bike around 130 beats per minute, running around 140, swimming, I don't know, but probably 80-20. I would say swimming perhaps maybe a little higher just because it's easier, the chance of overtraining and injury is lower. But when you're doing 30 to 40 hours a week, if you are able to do that for 16 weeks, the only way that that's happening is if the intensity is low enough. So most of that volume was coming from cycling, where, you know, if you're going out to Mount Palomar Mountain, or you're going out to, you know, in the desert, Escondido or Julian, these long rides, you're averaging 29 kilometers an hour, which for someone that can hold, you know, 45 to 47 K an hour on a bike is going to be in the green zone. And the running, when I look back at those training journals, my average training pace was probably about 4 minutes per kilometer, a little bit over. But, you know, then once in a while, there'd be like a hard training race or a hard tempo run, like a 13. There was one where it was 13 kilometers tempo and like 39, high 39. So it's like sub 5 minute miles in training, but it's like once every 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
I think that 80-20 really does make a lot of sense. I think the volume is really important. And it's to me, as I look back, it's relative to how fast you want to be. So if you want to be a 4 hour marathoner, then volume is a little bit different because you're out there for 4 hours, but you're also not pounding as if you were running 20 kilometers an hour. So there's slight things that have to change. The big difference, I think, is if you compare what you need to do to someone who's like a 2 hour marathoner or 205, then there's risk that happens because they probably do have to do a certain level of volume that is just, you know, for us is like overwhelming, 250 kilometers. The average person should try to maximize their volume, but has to think of what can I structurally handle as well? What can I mentally handle with everything else I have? Because it's a combined stress, right? So when you're doing something full-time like sport, if you don't have a job, if you don't have other things, then you mentally get to decompress as well. So it's not just sort of the physical strain, it's also the psychological strain of like, am I recovering mentally from being out there after doing a 2-hour ride or a 4-hour ride? And if you have a job and a family, it's a little bit different. But definitely the volume, and probably in the early years when you're building that foundation and the muscles are being trained and the mitochondria inside the muscles, one thing I always noticed from doing high volume was I would, especially in cycling, is I would never blow up. So you would get tired, you slow down, but then I could recover. And that I think is just from lots of volume of just sort of getting deep inside the muscles, the mitochondria, building up more density in there, and that helps. And then just being careful with how much intensity that we do, because it's risk of injury is really the biggest factor, but it's probably also the recovery factor too, because as we know, we get better through recovery. And if you're doing something really, really hard, we may feel like we've recovered, but if you really tested yourself, you would notice that it takes longer than you think to truly recover. It's like the marathon. We feel good sometimes a few days later, but if someone tested us in a lab, they'd see that our muscles were damaged, and you'd probably notice that muscle damage 2 to 3 weeks even after the marathon, mm-hmm. when you feel no soreness.
Yeah, 100%. And being as motivated as you were, like, at that stage, like, I mean, I can only imagine, like, being, like, in your late teens and, like, I mean, I was not training the way I train now for any of this, but, like, looking back and something I could have changed, like, oh, man, I wish I would have done more track. I wish I would have had an interest in this early, but everything happens for a reason, you know? But it sounds like you also paid attention to the fatigue and also the recovery components of it. And I like that you mentioned building a base, because I think so many times, especially with new runners, like, I think there's a lot that can be said about like how far the sport's come, but it also gets people really excited to run like longer distances in shorter amounts of time, or like, hey, I want to go run a marathon. Or, but just to keep in mind, like, I had a hockey soccer background from the age of 12, and then I slowly got into running more after soccer, but you know, that's created a base for me. You had the cross country, some competitive cross country running as well, but the cross country skiing and then cycling. And so your body's adapted, and with just like almost like passion training, it's just like, I like to bike from here to there. And so the body has a chance to build. And when I was training for Ironman, same thing, I was training with my coaches that were training for ultra, but I was just going out to get the volume with them. Right. First of all, it was a slower pace because they were training for, Ultraman. Yeah. But I was getting those benefits of going out for these 5-hour rides or 6-hour rides that were slower. Yeah. So yeah, I got to, before I even got into marathon, got to build my muscles, got to get the benefits of those gains, you know, but without the super intense work. So I think that's like, I think something I try and drive home now, it's like, and the more I hear about it, the more I read, the more I talk to people, and you're kind of like validating that as well. Like, it's, you know, couch to marathon is a thing, and like,
yeah,
but you don't want like it could quickly be couch to couch. Cause like,
totally,
just as quickly as you get up, you could be, dealing with an injury or fracture or something like that, if you don't take the time to build that structure.
Yeah. Know? Yeah, I think so. And I think for most people, I wouldn't say that I didn't have any coaches. There were a few people that were definitely influencers and helped me out. One of them actually is a Montreal guy, Pierre Blanchette, who's the director of the MAA, and he started me actually getting into triathlon set up, because he had gone, and he was a very good triathlete himself, went to Hawaii, and again, like Paulo Saldana, McGill grad, exercise physiology, I believe. So I had a good understanding of how that worked, and done a lot of testing in the labs there, and was a forerunner. So I would not necessarily have him be sort of my coach for my whole career, but I would definitely go back to people like that for advice, and sometimes for even a structured piece. Like, you know, can you help me sort of design the next like couple of months, or what do you think about this? The coaching is probably really key, because for as much as we can talk about it's important for the 80-20 and to respect that, we have this tendency sometimes that we feel good and we want, it feels good to run fast. It feels good to swim and push ourselves. Having someone out there who can look at us objectively and really kind of design it, I think is probably the right approach for the vast majority of people, to have someone there who can do that for us. It's very easy and it's very tempting to push a little too hard. And you're right, you can go from couch to couch and those mm-hmm. injuries creep up. And especially if you're not, you know, if you're older, you don't recover from those injuries as well. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
Do you find that now?
Definitely.
Yeah.
I have to be very careful now, because I always joke, it's the mind writes checks the body can't cash. Like yeah. I have like muscle memory. I go do workouts, you know, I'm training with John LaFranco now, and I'm running with like some super fast runners like François Jarry and whatnot. And we'll go and do stuff on the track, and I'll be running 35 seconds for 200. And I'm like, that was my 10K pace in the 90s. Like I, you know, that's what I ran like 29 and changed 10K. And now it's like feeling like my 1500 pace, but the muscle memory is there and the brain still thinks it can do it. But I have to be careful, because I just, you know, physically I'm not at that level anymore. And it's normal that I wouldn't be at that level, but you have to watch that for sure. Mm. And as an older athlete, the recovery, takes a lot longer. You can be, interestingly, I'm seeing, and we'll probably move there in a little bit, is I'm seeing progressions again after taking a long break, and I'm seeing myself getting faster, but I'm having to be clever about it. I'm having to really, you know, hence now I've got a coach, and I'm having to be smart about how I train, and like, what does easy running mean? And, you know, how much time do I need between hard sessions? And what are the signs of, like, is that just a twinge, or is that like something coming on here? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you can't afford to really have, you know, be laid up anymore for 3 months.
Yeah, that's it. did you experience any of that, like leading up to that 92 season, like your, what seems to feel like you're leading to your peak in the sport of triathlon? Were you as attentive to injury, and were you as careful with your recovery and all that stuff, even at that peak?
Yeah. What's interesting about 92, so, and for those that don't know the background, so in 1992, I was World Cup champion. So that's winning the series for triathlons. There was probably 10 races throughout the year, probably did 8 or 9 of them. The first part of the winter, that was that 16-week massive amount of training. And then the rest of the year was really 15 to 20 hours max. And I wasn't paranoid about injury, because I wasn't getting any injuries that were lasting more than sort of a couple of days, luckily. But I was paying very close attention to how I was feeling. And what I was going to mention earlier is documentation for me is really important of the stats. So for me, resting heart rate, daily weight, rate of perceived exertion for each sport, and then cumulative rate of perceived exertion for the day and for the week. And after a long time, this becomes a lot of data, and then you see trends. So for me, like, even the rate of perceived exertion for a whole week leading up to like my peak races, I could see a trend. It was always sort of like 79 to 84 cumulative. An easy run might be 3 on 10. A race was a 10 on 10. But all of these little things really is what I looked at. So I was starting to become very attuned to my body. So I would go out for a run, and for sure I'd be thinking of like, do I feel any sense of injury? But I'm feeling more about, do I feel like I'm ready to go? And what is that feeling? What is that feeling on Monday when I'm going to race on Sunday that tells me I'm really ready? Mm-hmm. And then you look back after good races and you start to notice the patterns. And I think, again, for myself, maybe I was lucky that I didn't get injured in my early years, and that I naturally figured out how to kind of do this base training and then bring down the volume and be very specific. So those 15 to 20 hour weeks were very specific. It was like, you know, a piano, as we used to say in cycling, like very easy. Mm-hmm. Or it was like really, really high intensity. the injuries that I had, to be honest, came from bike crashes, mostly falling off my bike, as opposed to a couple of overuse injuries, one in particular, but nothing serious. More bike crashes, I think, was really the...
During racing or training?
Both.
Yeah.
You know, getting hit by a taxi, cycling, car door opening. I used to do some bike racing, like the Marty Lachines, the crits down in Lachine, and actually won one year, which was really good.
Wow.
Yeah, a solo breakaway.
Jeez.
But one time with the tubulars, maybe not enough glue on the rim, and the tube came off going down a corner at like 60K an hour, and you've got the little thin skin suit, and it was just across the road, raspberried, over the sidewalk, into someone's front lawn.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing, because now you're all cut up everywhere, and there's like, you get infections, and it's, yeah.
So that was your, that's part of the sport that I haven't had with the exception of falling at a stop sign when I first learned to clip in, I haven't had the pleasure of experiencing yet, which I'm really happy about. But they look pretty nasty. But
yeah,
with the speed comes the risk, you know, I guess. And
especially, you know, we used to say, like, there's two kinds of cyclists, those that have fallen and those that will fall. And you're right, I think you're pushing the limits. And I remember some World Cup races were in Europe, and where you would have descents and, you know, technical descents, and people joke about triathletes not really being great bike handlers. Probably what was more of a joke back in my day, I remember doing some professional cycling races like Gastown Grand Prix, Tour de White Rock, with like Tour de France level cyclists in there who were not happy to see me in the race.
Yeah.
And, like, use some of that technology, try geek. But the truth is that if we didn't come from a cycling background, we didn't have those skills. And, you know, I did ride with professional cyclists, and in the winter we would go out in the snow, and we would ride our bikes in the snow and pick up hockey pucks, like literally learn how to like reach all the way down to the ground, and you learn how to do control skids and learn how to bunny hop sidewalks and all of these things, ride in a pack, very important skills, descend. And so in Europe, where I did see some injuries, I didn't have any, thankfully, but some of my friends who were triathletes had some unfortunate ones, were just on the technical, because you're competing, you're going down hills, mm-hmm. and taking risks that you maybe shouldn't be taking, but you're competitive and you want to win.
Mm-hmm.
And some people crashing on those technical descents there, where you get some, you know, broken collarbones or broken arms.
Mm. Yeah. The way of training and the way, like, their accessibility to these kind of, like the Alps and stuff like that. Like,
yeah,
they just have a skill set that we're, you know, we can do our best to practice them where we live. And I think that's key, but we don't have the luxury of like having those training playgrounds to practice on all the time. So that's where they probably have the advantage.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Like, what was the goal for 92 and for you, and was that your best moment? Was that your best year?
Yeah. So it was, and yeah, so probably that's a good, like, we can walk through 92 and then bring it up to sort of, you know, what sort of progressed after that, and we can get to where I am. But 92 was the year where I committed, you know, as we talked about, to really full-time moving to California, training full-time, and then getting on the ITU circuit to do the ITU races. And I didn't have a goal per se of saying I wanted to be World Cup champion or I wanted to be world champion that year, but I did want to be legitimate in being a professional. And so I started that year. I said, I'm going to go to every World Cup race that I can get to. And the first race was San Andreas in Colombia. And that one was a good race. I think I was definitely top 10. And then I came back to Montreal and had a little bit of a break, did a couple of duathlons. And then I went to a race in California, which was not a World Cup race, but it was a big race called the Mazda Orange County Performing Arts, where first place was like a Mazda Miata. There was like big prize money and like everybody was going to be there. And this was the week before the week, right around the week of Mohabiton, which was a big triathlon here in Montreal, up in Quebec. So I went down to do this race. Nobody knew who I was, except for a couple people that had seen me training that winter. And I ended up coming second in that race to Greg Welsh, but it took him about 6 kilometers on the run to catch me. Came out of the water in the top three. Mike Pigg caught me on the bike, and it was a very, very hilly run. And I ran, I think, 33 flat. Greg ran probably about 30 seconds faster. But this was the first race where people were saying, okay, who is this guy? Like, he's 19 years old. Like, he almost just won this race, picked up 5,000 US. And for me, it was just sort of like a coming out. And so I came back to Montreal, and that really boosted my confidence. And then I went and did a local race here, Mohabiton, which was part of the Royal Lepage series, which was a big race. We had prize money, and we had all of the best triathletes in Canada coming to do that race. And then I went back onto the World Cup circuit, went over to Europe. We had a race in Sweden, which I won. We had a race in Portaferry, Ireland. I got second to Brad Bevan. Mm-hmm. Moscow, where I had a massive bike crash and thought I'd broken my back.
Oh, no.
And was basically sent home with like a back brace. Couldn't finish the race. Laid up in bed. It was really just bad bruising. But, you know, 3 weeks after that, somehow or another, had recovered, went to the Canadian Championships in Kelowna, BC, which I won. Had a really, really strong race there. And then continued on the World Cup circuit, which was, there was one in Las Vegas, did a half marathon in California, raced Kenny Souza in a duathlon, which was a name if anyone knows from the past. He did beat me, but I gave him a good run for his money.
Yeah.
And then we finished off the World Cup season with Monte Carlo, and then we flew down to Brazil. And then the last race was at the end of November, 92 in Ixtapa. And Brad Bevan, who's a very, very famous triathlete from Australia, still, I think, coaches, great guy, was ahead of me. We were basically neck and neck for the whole season. And it came down to the last race, and it was one of these number games where if I won and Brad was fifth or worse, then I was going to be World Cup champion. Like, the numbers just worked out. And in the end, I won. I think Brad got fifth. It was just a great experience overall. And it was, you know, I got the trophy. I got some good prize money. I've got, you know, La Presse and Gazette calling me in Ixtapa. Mm-hmm. It's like, it was amazing. I came back. There were like radio interviews. And it was really, it was well received by the press, especially in Montreal and in Quebec. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about that high performance sport kind of thing about, you know, Gaétan Boucher and Pierre Harvey, this was the kind of thing where locally I was getting on the front page of the Gazette for these kinds of wins. And so it was really legitimizing the sport, and it was really giving me that validation that I can continue. So 1992 was an amazing year because, yes, I was World Cup champion. Yes, I was sponsored. You know, I had Reebok International, I had Swiss Air, I had great sponsors. Everyone, like, when you win, everyone's calling you up.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, it was like, for 93, I get to go back to California and do this all over again.
Yeah.
That was what was exciting. So that was sort of the beginning, and I carried that on. And you know, you have your ups and your downs, and not every year is the best, but really had a great time doing it from 92. And I got out of the sport in 98 officially, started to sort of teeter out in 97. And a lot of people sort of question perhaps why that was. What they don't know or didn't sort of fully appreciate was that I had really quit school and let a lot go. I mean, a lot of the people I was competing against were sometimes 10 years older than me, and they had finished university or college, and they were like Division I, NCAA Division I swimmers who now were doing triathlons. Well, I didn't have any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I got to, you know, 97, I would have been 25. and then 98, 26. And eventually, now we know it's going to be the Olympics. So it was never even, it was not an Olympic sport when I started, and it was not expected to be an Olympic sport. So that's not why I got into triathlons. But we were part of the move in getting it there. And by 98, we knew it would be an Olympic sport in 2000. Some people say, well, why wouldn't you keep going on? It's like, well, you know, you got to remember, probably from 96 onwards, I was starting to think about what's next. Because
the planner in you.
The planner in me. And I say it's not golf. So I always joke, like, I wasn't going to be reading, you know, Dostoevsky novels at Starbucks for the rest of my life. Like, we made a legitimate living off the sport. And I did quite well for a number of years, but it's all relative. And for the same reason that I wanted to sort of let school go to see if I could be a professional triathlete so that I had no regrets later in life of wondering if I could, I also started to think, I don't want to have regrets about saying, oh, I wish I had gone to finish more of my schooling, but I didn't do that. And so once that seed is planted, then it starts to grow a little bit. And by the time we got to 98, Nike was one of my sponsors, and we were looking at renewing, and those were going to be four-year contracts through the Olympics. Simon Whitfield was a guy some people know, a couple of years younger than me. He was about to get to my level. Like, we were racing, and he was starting to, like, really get good. And I just thought, you know what? This is the time for me to, like, move on. Like, I was in Flagstaff, Arizona training. I didn't really have the same passion anymore. And I had a little bit of a business going on the side. So I had other things. And I decided, you know what? I think I'm done with triathlon. And actually, looking back, it was the best decision I could have made. I had a great career. I had some great results. Three-time Canadian champ, you know, that silver medal at the Commonwealth Games, World Cup champion, ranked second in the world in 94. Some really, really great experiences of traveling the world and meeting some amazing people. And it was time to move on and do something else. And so that's kind of like how I got out of it. And I really did get out at 98. And I did a couple of triathlons when I went back to university in 2001. But I really didn't do anything after that, which was kind of interesting because I'm doing, you know, running like more than 20 years later. But I was thinking back the other day, and I was like, you know, I was doing sport at a young age, but there was this break from 98, frankly, until about 2014, where I didn't do a lot. So it's not like I have 30 years of continuous. My career is relatively broken up with like a 10-year stint and then like this like 10 to 15-year block of not much. And then now in my 40s, sort of doing marathons. But that was it. So a long answer to your question about 92.
Yeah.
But yes, it was a pivotal and a very memorable year, and just a great experience. You know, I mean, it's a great experience to sort of get to achieve a goal that you had, and that goal was to say you wanted to be the best in the world at something, and that actually kind of happens. I can't say that's ever happened again in my life, nor do I expect that it will. So you know what? It was just great memories and taught me a lot of life lessons too, which I use even to this day.
And what, can you share some of those actually? Cause I'm always curious to know, like, I know how much the process and everything's taught me, through running, but, what are some key learnings that you can look back on that you can share?
I think the main one for me, and now, you know, in my late 40s and I have a full-time job and I have a family, is really the head game for me is huge, and being like true to yourself in terms of have amazingly lofty goals, have big dreams, but also be true to yourself in terms of what's realistic of what we can handle, so that you can persevere. Because we talk about grit and we throw these words around like grit and perseverance, but they tend to be a function of being able to handle what you've gone after. So if you put too much on the plate, you run the risk of sort of like either stopping or burning out and whatnot. And I think what it really taught me was, yes, I had this process and I reverse engineered back from a 10-year plan. But it was very systematic and it was very focused on, like, it's not about quitting. It's about how do I get to where I need to get to. So I kind of build things in a way that increase the likelihood of me accomplishing that, because I don't set myself up for, or I try to avoid setting myself up for major setbacks by taking on more than I can handle, but it's a steady grind and it doesn't stop. And that's really, I think, what made me different than a lot of other athletes. I was not the most naturally gifted person, but there were very, very few that could work as consistently hard as I did. And it wouldn't be, it's not the 40-hour week. It's the consistency of that training, and it's the dedication and the sacrifice. And you put all of that together and you repeat it for many, many years. And then you see success. Because for me, success has always been a function of like what you kind of gave up. It's not necessarily the winning the race. Had I not been World Cup champion, I think I would still feel just as happy about the experience. It's really that process that I developed to sort of get to where I wanted to go. And I started with the end goal and I reverse engineered back. And then you keep reevaluating, how am I doing? Am I on track? Are the trends looking good? So there's a lot of feedback that I look for too in what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And I do that in my job, and I do that in everything. And then I have this other thing too, which is the 75-25 rule, which is that generally speaking in life, 75% of what we do should be enjoyable and 25% should be sort of a grind, and it should be a struggle. And if we fall out of that ratio, to me, it's sort of a red flag that maybe something's off balance. And that's for work is the same way. Like, you're tired, maybe didn't get enough sleep, you're working hard. But generally that 75-25 has worked well for me in terms of how to find that balance and just keep persevering at what you want to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Those are all good, really good points. And I think that's one thing I really enjoy about the process, is that it does teach you ways you can improve other parts of your life and not just in sport. But I'm just curious, like being at such a high level. And I think I like the fact that you said that you weren't like the most gifted athlete, but you just worked harder than everybody. I think that's a really nice lesson, because, it's sometimes it's the most gifted athletes that don't make it to the top of their sport because they don't have the work ethic. So it's not just one component, and you see it in hockey, you see it in all kinds of sports. Some kids just, they have all the ability in the world, but the work, you still need to practice, you still need to work, you still need to build to kind of to get that going.
Yep.
But my question was like, being around those, you mentioned a few names that like actually went on to do like Ironman and stuff like that. And I know like it was part of the allure for me when I started out doing Olympics too. And then I was like, I met a couple Ironman athletes and in my coaches, and that's kind of where I wanted to go. Cause like, I mean, maybe I'm victim of the marketing and all that stuff, but
yeah.
What did that ever creep into your mind? Like, it doesn't have to be a super long-winded answer, but
yeah,
just like I'm always curious. Like, I always want to do the next distance, and like, but you kind of stayed in that Olympic range.
No, I think I always wanted to do an Ironman. I just never got around to doing one.
Hmm.
It was a big part of the sport, and for sure, like the Hawaii Ironman is really, what I think has made triathlon as popular as it is. I think the Olympics has definitely helped to a large extent as well. But we all know the Hawaii Ironman, and I think a lot of people remember even NBC and the human story there of having not just the pros but other people sort of doing that race. It just didn't happen. I think racing the World Cup circuit, I wouldn't have been able to do it at that time. And then by then I got out of it and I moved on to other things. My late 20s and 30s would have been the time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And there were people that were trying to egg me to get back in and for a while there, but who knows, maybe one day, just to say that I've done one, mm-hmm. I'll go back and do it.
That's awesome. I think like there's no age you can put on it either.
Yeah.
Like you can still come back and
yeah.
And you're proving some pretty amazing results in your marathon times too. But you mentioned that gap too. Like, what did you do from, was it 97 to?
Yeah, 98
to 2014 or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, what I did is like when you decide to get out of sport, especially at that level, you naturally go through a period of adjustment, especially being very, very young, having to figure out, okay, what's next? So while I did go back to university in 2001, there were a few years there that I sort of had, like, you know, side jobs and whatnot that I had been involved with in sport related. But I sort of kept that up and just really a transition. So focused more on sort of, I had some personal training stuff going on. Had some other types of sporting businesses going on, and then just sort of eventually came around to saying, okay, you know what, now I'm ready to go back to school. So 3 years of probably really kind of just having to forget about it and trying not to, like, look at the magazines and purposely avoiding it just mm-hmm. to sort of get it out of your system. And then getting back into school, when I went back to school, I did do a little bit of work with the McGill Triathlon Club. I just had some friends that were involved, and so I was there helping a little bit, which got me into some training. So I got back and doing a few runs, a few swims, and dabbled in a couple of races, but maybe like 5-6 hours a week. And that was through 2001 to 2004. And then I went to work afterwards. So I went back and went into commerce and then in accounting. And then I went to work at Deloitte, and then it was very busy. And, you know, I was in my 30s by that point and probably, like, feeling some aches and pains, and probably in hindsight, looking back, because I wasn't working out, I was feeling those aches and pains, but it kind of told me, like, just let it go and focus on work. So from 2004 to 2014, I hardly did anything. And I mean, I think this year I'm going to finish at like 4,800 kilometers of running. I don't think I ran 50 kilometers in those 10 years. And actually it's interesting because I was like, oh, my back was killing, and I was like, oh, I don't know, like, you know, lower back issues. And, my son was born in 2010. So that was a big focus for me. And then by 2014, I just started to feel like, okay, now I'm feeling out of shape. Like, this is not who I was. And you get a little older and the body changes a little bit, and it's just, so I have and he's been on the podcast, I have a very close friend of mine, Scott Sternthal, who's an osteopath, and we were talking, we hadn't really connected in a while. So I just sort of gave him an update as to how things are going and said, you know, I haven't run in a long time, and I'm like, you know, 30, 40 pounds heavier than I am now, my back. And he said, well, why don't you just come in and we'll check it out. So I went in for a session, and I was talking about my crash, because I did crash on my bike in 92 in Russia in a World Cup race. And it's like, yeah, it's down, you know, my L5 S1. And he's kind of up somewhere else looking around and poking. And make a long story short, we did a couple of sessions, and then he said, why don't you just get on a treadmill and just 20 minutes, like, you know, 6 miles an hour, super easy, just get back. And here we are. You know, that was 2014, and now we're end of 2019, almost 6 years later. And so that's how I got back in, is it just, like, those couple of sessions really kind of reset me a little bit. And then we started to train together. So it was kind of like we get up in the morning. Scott was an ultra marathoner, so he slowly got me into, like, come on in the morning, just come for, like, you know, 10K.
And the secret number, I think, is about an hour or so.
Yeah, exactly.
Not for you there, but.
No, but it was, I tell you what, though, which was interesting for me was that it was the first time in my life I had really seen how much training makes a difference. Because even in the late 2001, when I went back to school and I hadn't done much in a couple of years, I was still like 29, like 30 years old. I was still coming back very, very quickly. When I came back in 2014, it was like 30-minute 5K was really hard. Mm-hmm. I really had lost a lot, you know, just you get older and whatnot. And so, yeah.
That's pretty interesting, because, like, yeah, 30-minute 5K, and you were running 30-minute 10Ks in your prime. And like, what a humbling thing that must be.
And it was very humbling.
You know what I mean? Like, I think that's what I find most interesting about you, is that, when I met Andrew, actually, I met him, in a 10K race, actually, in Pointe Claire, and where I kind of around where I grew up. And I came out fast, and I was like, oh, it's a small race. Like, there's not going to be much competition here. So I did try and like put my foot on the pedal and took the early lead till about 6K. And I got passed by a guy that ended up being Andrew. And this was only a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And shook your hand at the finish. But then later ran with you and heard a little bit more about you and had no idea you had this kind of pedigree. But you're like a super humble human being as well. So it's you don't always expect that from top athletes. But the more I get to meet the elites, it's quite nice. But it's never too late to come back, right? It's,
no.
And almost to relearn how to be an athlete again, you know? And what was that like? And how, like, was that difficult for you to, was it a tough pill to swallow when you went out for that 5K, 30-minute 5K? But were you more determined to kind of like, and was your plan never to come back and start running marathons? Because that's where you're at right now.
No, I think it started with actually gratitude, being able to get back. And there was quite a bit of pain and discomfort for those years. And again, for whatever reason, it's probably just having, you know, sitting down at a desk job, but being grateful that I could get back and suddenly go for a run and like my lower back feeling better. So that was number one. And then, you know, once you get into your 40s, and this will resonate with people sort of in the same sort of age group as me, is you start to appreciate time differently. And so it was more about just being grateful and appreciating the fact that I'm getting older, but I can return to health. I can return to a high level of fitness relative, obviously. But now I need to respect that, and I need to. So it really was about saying, I'm going to get back in and I'm making a new commitment to myself, but it's more about a lifestyle choice of just being healthy and realigning my values. So saying, I'm going to work hard. I've got a family, but my job is at the end of the day, a job. And I'm going to be healthy, and I'm not going to compromise that. I'm not going to compromise my health. You know, my son is going to be 10 years old, so if I'm healthy, that's good for him. It's good for a lot of things, and running is a great way to do that. And you know, the ultra, which I did, I completed one 50 miler in Bear Mountain in New York.
Mm.
Scott
loves that one.
Scott loves it. He's won the marathon there. He's finished the 50 miler a few times. This was a reconnection for me on some level with my boarding school days of cross country running in the woods and why I got into sport in the first place. So I go to boarding school and I do the Terry Fox run and I find out I'm good at running and this is a new thing for me. And I'm cross country running in the woods there. You're exploring. And then you become this professional triathlete. Now you're getting paid. Now you're getting interviews. Now you're famous. Now you leave that go. You go to school. And then years later, you reconnect. And it sort of brought it back full circle.
Mm-hmm.
So for the first couple of years, it was really just that reconnection of going to Mount Royal in the morning and running and just loving it.
Mm-hmm.
And then as the base build up, I guess, as the years went on. So now it's like 2 years, 3 years that I've been running and I'm not like, pain. I mean, the first time I ran 15K, I couldn't walk for a week. And then, so then I said, okay, well, let's, you know, put some goals to this. So that's how the marathoning came in. And then I've become really, really fascinated with the ability to progress and improve as sort of an older athlete. And seeing now, like I ran 2:43 in Toronto, my goal is to break 2:40 before I turn 50. And to see that that's actually kind of realistic for me, and it's all relative, but to see that progression of like not even being able to do a 30-minute 5K in 2014 to now like being able to run, you know, low 2:40s for a marathon, I just find that like fascinating. But it's just good to be healthy and good to be fit.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm enjoying it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're showing some really, it's fun to have you too, like in the field. Cause, those are like similar goals to what I have right now. And
yeah.
I'm a bit younger than you are, but it's fun to, just like we did that day in the 10K, to have you on the course and like also like a potential training partner and stuff like that.
Totally.
Somebody around your speed is always a good, it's always a good idea. Like we touched on before.
Yeah.
Did was the running the only thing that changed, or had you changed, eating habits or like nutrition? We didn't really touch on that at all, but, Have you kind of been steady in your nutrition, or has it changed for you over the years?
I'd say I've always been pretty good with the nutrition. I pay attention to it a little bit more, but I've always eaten well. I've always avoided, you know, I would say certainly fast food. I've always avoided, I don't think I made too many changes there, except perhaps just being conscious of like fruits and vegetables and sleep. I try to think about that because I'm not a huge sleeper. So I try to get in at least seven hours a day. Mm-hmm. But no, overall, structurally too, I just think about sort of, again, because I'm older, like resistance training and just core strength and just things that are just going to be fundamental now to making sure, because the aerobic system is still going well, but I have to be careful just about sort of the ligaments and tendons and soft tissue and whatnot. Even working to think like, okay, try not to sit down for 2 hours if you don't have to get up, walk around, keep your mobility. Now I have a full-time coach, and that's made a big difference. That's been a game changer for me as I've gotten older. I think I got away with it up to a certain point, but now I'm really just like, I'm not thinking about it as much. I'm just trusting the process, and that I've noticed in the last year a big difference. Mm-hmm. Because it's qualified objective guidance in terms of how to train properly and avoid injury, and that's been great for me. I see a lot of people too on social media at various ages sort of kind of finding their own coaches and stuff, and I think that's great.
Mm-hmm. How do you find the world is different now with social media compared to when you were growing up?
You know, it's the amount of information available to people is probably overwhelming at times. It's a lot of fun, but it can be overwhelming. I think it's the challenge is how do you distill it and find out what's kind of really right versus what's unqualified. So I think it's amazing that you can, you know, and I work in technology, and so this is part of what I do day to day. But it's about sort of grounding yourself and anchoring yourself to some key people and key sources of authoritative information. That's where you go to find out what you need to. Mm-hmm. And then you can enjoy the chatter on the other sides, but there's a lot. I mean, if you follow everything and like Let's Run and you're on, you know, Instagram and you Google and whatnot, I mean, it's incredible. We didn't have that. I mean, you had your magazines, you had to wait for your triathlete magazine to come out at the end of the month to read what was going on.
Yeah.
Or you were at a library. If you were really a geek, you were actually going to go read some like scientific, you know, study about, you know, whatever. And, you know, that's how you got your information nowadays. It's there for everybody. But the risk is that you don't always know how much of it's true, how much of it is just anecdotal. I mean, even talking today, a lot of what I did is still anecdotal. It's not, it's not absolutely proven. Find those people out there that have the background, and there are lots of them, but yeah, anchor yourself to that source of truth there that is for you, the way that you're going to sort of define how you do what you do.
Exactly.
And then enjoy the rest if that's what you want to kind of
go
and read about it or hear about it.
And I hear good things about John too. I hear he's a great coach, and I actually want to pick his brain too, actually, on the podcast, which could be fun.
Yeah.
Is there any other piece of literature today that you've read recently that validates what you're doing in your training or your past training practices?
Look, the validation, I think it comes up through seeing a lot of papers and a lot of blogs and a lot of people talking about sort of the concept of polarized training. I think that we see sort of, it's very pervasive across, even if, you know, through social media, you see that. But no, I mean, John's training is very good, and I've known John like loosely for a number of years, even back in the McGill days when I used to train with the track team there. It's probably based on a number of different types of theories, but fundamentally it's about, you know, it's good base, it's consistency, it's specificity. And I took 10 minutes off my marathon time just in 1 year. But I like his style too. He's a good guy. Mm-hmm. And the team is amazing. there's an association with Concordia, which is fun. So if I get to give back, like there's an element of, I enjoy going to the workouts too with the younger kids, and just as I get to know them more and more, we can have some conversations and give back. That's a lot of fun for me too.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no.
Pay it forward in a sense. It's always a good thing.
Oh, absolutely.
I was able to get a lot of knowledge from my coaches and all their experiences. Like you, they traveled for triathlon and, you know, not at that level obviously, but it's such a nice community and so many lessons they've taught me that every time I'm out running with people, new people, I always try and share something with them that I've learned or picked up, or even just on this podcast, learning from different guests and stuff like that. Like Mel Myron came on the show, and I learn a lot from her all the time, and try and just pay it forward as best you can. But it's nice to kind of give back to the next generations for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
What is running? What is this whole life of athletics? What has it meant to you?
Well, I mean, it's really defined me over the years. It started, you know, with giving me that confidence and being that one thing that showed me for the first time when I was 14 that I was perhaps better than average at something. And that was kind of it for me, is being better than average. And then it's taught me sort of what happens when you put your mind to certain goals and you focus and you dedicate and you sacrifice. And so it's become part of my DNA, really. And then it's turned into, you know, obviously it was part of what I did for a living for a number of years, but it's become part of the lifestyle for me of just being healthy and not looking at life in terms of like chronology, more than just sort of trying to always be healthy and fit and balanced. So I mean, there's other things I like to do as well, but really trying to be fit and healthy. And I think running is that, and it's connected me socially too, because I think, you know, especially as you get older and you're working, you have a family, it's harder and harder to sort of maintain those like those friendships and those close connections. And I know like Strava, like the Facebook for runners, this is fantastic. Mm-hmm. You know, this is where I, you know, I have people that follow me on Strava. I don't have many, but there are some, and there are some in particular that I've watched for the number of years who started, couldn't even run like 5K in an hour. And now I'm watching them do like a 10K or a half marathon, and I see the progression. And maybe it's, I don't know what the background, but maybe one recovering from something, but there's been a struggle and there's been an incredible amount of dedication. And I know for a number of years, I was like the only one that gave this one person a kudos.
Mm-hmm.
And then like, I can just imagine that these kinds of things really make a difference to people. So I love that part of it. I love using social media to sort of connect with people, and maybe, as you said, impart, you know, a little bit of what I've learned and try to influence in a positive way. But it's part of my life. Running is part of my life, and the community is great. Montreal is an amazing running community.
Yeah, it's great.
It's really, really evolving. I'm glad to see like there's this new, I find, in surge of running passion that maybe I'm just paying attention to, but it reminds me of the late 80s and early 90s when it was like that. You know, it's like,
yeah,
running was a big deal, and I feel like it's becoming that here.
It's exciting.
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah, it's traveling and going to other places like Boston and New York and even Toronto. You see like the communities emerging and pulling communities together and getting people out, like really changing lives. Because I think that, you know, you do get a lot of new people coming out too, or people that take breaks between, you know, their athletics, and then like you, like went to work and then come back into running and find that passion and that freedom, you know, again. But yeah, it's super exciting. What's next for you in this year coming up? This episode will be January 6th, I think. So it'll be fresh into the new year. What's your resolution looking like?
I'm going to sign up for Chicago next year.
Okay.
So I'm going to go to Chicago. The goal, my real focus running-wise in terms of performance, is to break 2 hours, 40 minutes. So I'm 47 now. I've got 2 years and a bit before I turn 50. That's sort of the objective. I think it's a realistic one. It's a little ambitious, but the 2:43 at Toronto is gave me some hope.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to do Chicago. I'll probably do the Montreal half, Scotia in April again. And after that, we'll have to see. You know, I like to probably race 4 to 5 times a year. Maybe just one marathon this year. Maybe, you never know. If I'm feeling really, really good, I might just, you know, last year I ran Longueuil in May. I woke up and it was like 2 weeks after I ran Bear Mountain for the marathon. I was like, I'm feeling good. I think I've got a good one in me today.
Yeah.
So I did that. But planning for one marathon and really... really going to take the winter to focus more on some speed. So doing some stuff at like 1500, 3000 pace and try to hone that in a little bit. I think if I can get that down to some faster times, that it's going to maybe help. There's a huge strength component to that marathon, but just a little bit more of the speed too. Just give me a little bit more efficiency there and make that, you know, 3:47 per kilometer feel a little bit more fluid. Mm-hmm. So we're going to work on that a little bit.
And will you work on the strength training over the winter too? Like, is that part of your game?
Yeah. We've got a pretty good strength program. It's not overly complicated. It's focusing on large muscle groups and fundamentals, pull-ups, push-ups, deadlifts, some squats and stuff like that. I love resistance bands. That to me has been a game changer for hip issues. Mm. So I use one basically just kind of in some pivoting and some tracking exercises. I like to do that before most runs.
Mm-hmm.
Activation. I found this muscle I'd never knew I had called a glute muscle.
Oh, yes.
And it's
problematic, actually.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. I've been able to sort of activate glutes in a different way, and maybe because of the cycling I never had to worry about that as a triathlete, but as a runner, getting some sore hips and whatnot, that to me has been very, very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Well, thanks so much for coming in today. It's been a real pleasure and hearing your story and progression as an athlete, and I know you'll do some great things in 2020, and I'm sure you'll hit that mark that sub 240 mark before you hit 50 for sure. But we'll be there to celebrate with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
No problem. Take care.
Thanks.
This episode is brought to you by WRG Run Club. What's really good is running with people who are fun, friendly, and positive. Whatever your experience, age, or identity, you're welcome to join us at the base of Mount Royal every Monday night at 7 p.m. Just look for the group of smiling faces next to the monument. Some run fast, some run slow. Who you'll meet, you never know. If you want to learn more, visit our website, iamarunner.ca, and check out their Instagram, @WRGRuns. Hope to see you out there. Thank you for joining us on this episode of The Rundown. We hope you enjoyed our show. Please make sure to visit us at iamarunner.ca. You can also let us know what you think and follow us on Instagram, @TheRundown. Now take what you've learned and run with it.
The Rundown is a production by WRG Media, recorded in the historic RCA building in St. Henry, Montreal. Produced and recorded by Forrest McKay. Our executive producers, Leslie and Lindsay Woods. Graphics and illustrations created by Ryan Bondi and hosted by Justin Pugliese.